You coined the term of artificial life to describe the virtual ecosystem through computer simulation. And for you, this is a field of research it's a way for you to study a genuine nature in the grass. So, but my first question is a very trivial question, but why could we understand the nature of nature by the study of nature in vitro or in silico?
Yeah, well, the insight into all of this stems from the kind of the study that von Neumann did on self-reproducing automata. And so Arthur Birks, who actually completed von Neumann's work after he died, von Neumann did his work on self-reproducing machines and gave a lot of talks of it, but he never wrote it up. He gave a number of lectures, and he had all kinds of paperwork, but when he died, he had not written it up in any clean form. So Arthur Birks, who had worked with von Neumann on the ENIAC and the Institute for Advanced Study Computers, collected all his work on this and cataloged it and indexed it and edited it down and then published it together with some transcripts of some lectures that von Neumann gave. And so he characterized the question that von Neumann was asking was that von Neumann was interested in the phenomenon of self-reproduction, but he wasn't attempting to capture self-reproduction at the level of molecular biology, at the level at which it actually happens. He was after the necessary and sufficient conditions for a machine to reproduce itself. So he was after the phenomenon of self-reproduction at a higher level of abstraction. So what he got out of that was that once he figured out how to get a machine to reproduce itself, he noted that the information in the genome had to be used in two different ways. One, it had to be interpreted, so it had to be read and decoded as instructions to do this or that in building an offspring, for instance. But then it also had to be just passively copied. So it had to be used twice, one in an interpreted way and the other in a non-interpreted way. And once the structure of DNA was worked out, that turned out to be the case for genetic information. So the idea here is that once you've abstracted the logic that underlies some biological phenomenon, the actual material that happened to implement that logic that evolved here on Earth is really immaterial. And that one can do an awful lot of studies of the implications by just working with the logic. So another good case is Darwinian evolution. The underlying logic, although there's all of these mechanisms for producing variant genomes and things like that, it's not dependent on it being DNA. Okay, so working with the logic, you need two basic functions. You need, for existing organisms, to be able to produce offspring whose genomes are slight variants on each other, and those variations can be random, randomly correlated with the phenotypic effects that they're going to have. So you need a production of variation, and then you need some filter that says, you know, well, some of these go on to further reproduce themselves and produce variants, and some of them don't, and that's whatever the selective agent is. And if that's a breeder who's trying to get longer hair on a sheep, that's one selective agent. If it's several cold winters in a row where only the longer-haired sheep survive to reproduce, that's a natural selective agent. But if you have these two capabilities, that the existing things produce variations of their descriptions, and if there's some filter on those variations, so not all of them survive, only some of them survive, you have the necessary logical basis for Darwinian evolution to take hold. And so You don't need to study evolution. You don't have to use fruit flies or DNA to study evolution. You can put together populations of organisms that, in a computer, that fit these, so that those two functions are implemented in some way. And you can look at what the logical implications are for the process of evolution. And you will learn some things that, therefore, should be true about biological evolution, because it implements the same logic in different hardware, but that should be irrelevant. Okay, so as long as the functional building blocks implement the same logic, you can say legitimate things about any piece of hardware or software or wetware that implements the same logic. So many of the experiments that have replicated, you know, have led to coevolutionary processes in computers have given us interesting insights about evolution in the natural world.
If artificial life enlarges our understanding of life, does it mean that also that we must enlarge our conceptions about life, evolution? When you experiment, for instance, an unnatural natural selection process, you evoked this before, are you just simply confirming Darwin theory, or are you going to enrich it or take it in new directions?
I think we'll be enriching it and taking it new directions. I mean, the Darwin's insight was that this simple people had understood that evolution happens, but they didn't understand the mechanism. People understood by the time Darwin came on the scene, they understood very well that species weren't fixed. Okay, that, I mean, the earlier understanding was that, you know, all species were created at once and all species were stable and they stayed those species. But then it was demonstrated conclusively that lots of species have died out. So that species could die out was understood, and the mechanism was fairly easy to understand. There were changes in the climate or something like that that killed off lots of species. What wasn't understood was how do new species come in and replace them. So that species did seem to replace other species was also understood, but the overriding view was there must be special acts of creation to replace these things. So you always had a certain number of species, and so the mechanism for replacement of species was Darwin's insight, was how species get replaced, the origin of species. So that did a very good job of explaining the existing taxonomic data that was out there. But once he introduced that mechanism, since then, people have learned an awful lot more than Darwin himself understood about the implications of that logic for the world and for. The evolution of species. So, you know, ever since then, with the discovery of genetics and the actual mechanisms by which mutations happen and are propagated, and how some mutations are fixed, and the error code and things like that, we've understood. I mean, just the process of understanding Darwinian evolution has led to a large extension of the theory, and the ability to actually bring it much more carefully within the scope of the experimental method in computers, I think will only enhance our understanding of the implications of that logic. So now, it may or may not lead us to discover that there are other things besides just those two functions of production of variation and filter on variation that are important to evolution. So far, people keep proposing there must be something more, and people keep demonstrating eventually that, you know, what originally looked like they're things that can't be explained via these two simple functions ultimately turn out to be beautiful proofs that evolution is in fact happening. So, for instance, the evolution of cooperation, altruism, was initially thought the evidence that an organism would put itself at risk and therefore its own offspring at risk, its own contribution to future lineages, by, you know, squawking when there was a predator nearby to warn others. So it draws attention to itself, so the predator is more likely to get it. So one would initially have thought that on the earliest, on a simple interpretation of Darwinian evolution, that shouldn't evolve, because these simple mechanisms should lead to very self-interested organisms. But then with the studies of the evolution of cooperation and Hamilton's discovery that, you know, that social insects, the sisters, haploid sisters, are more closely related to each other than they would be to their offspring, it turned out to that you could explain it on strictly Darwinian terms. So it was originally raised as an objection to Darwinian evolution, and it proved to be an elegant proof that it was just strictly Darwinian evolution. So so much of the elaboration is just going to be to understand better and better how this simple mechanism continues to explain. But it is possible that we've discovered that there, for certain cases, there may be other factors involved. See, the thing you can do with computers that is difficult to do in the real world is you can rerun, you can do an ensemble of evolutionary trajectories. So, you know, to really understand biological evolution on Earth, it would be, as scientists, we'd love to be able to go back to the first, when life first started, and perturb the situation slightly, move the Earth a little further out of its orbit, change the chemical composition, or just stir the oceans a little bit, and then run it over and over again thousands and thousands of times to see what came up, what would be common to each of those trajectories. Those would be things you could build a theory out of, and things that were unique to each trajectory would be just the result of chance that got preserved by genetic inheritance. So in a computer, though, you can do this. You can rerun the experiment to get an ensemble of evolutionary trajectories from very well understood differences in initial state or parameters. So it allows you to experiment with the process of evolution and the products of evolution in a much more controlled way. So,
my next question maybe is very naive, but for a person who don't have any experience of a computer, what is a typical IAL experiment? What are the main materials and techniques involved? Well, the computer is the main thing.
The computer is the main thing, but then in order to do science, you need sort of the petri dish that you're studying. So you need the artificial world and its inhabitants. You need tools that are observing it and doing the analysis. And these are all programs. But so, for instance, you might have a part of your world would be a two-dimensional lattice that has entries in it for how much food there is in each point in space. And then there would be some other code that would represent individual organisms, and perhaps with little bit strings that were their genome. So if it's 1011, it will move this fast. If it's 1010, it will move a little slower. And so there's a bit string that characterizes their, that is interpreted to give rise to their behavior. They will be located, the organisms will be located at different points in the lattice, and they'll be able to move around in the lattice. And presumably what will happen is that they'll move around the lattice, and their different capabilities to get food and access food will lead to some of them going on to reproduce themselves, in which case you make copies of the bit strings that characterize them sloppily, so that you get they're mostly the same, but a few of the bits in their description might be changed. So the behavior will be a little different. The behavior of their offspring will be a little different. And so the population will continue to run. The population of organisms will change over time as the fitter ones come to the surface. And the fitness will be a function of not just the absolute conditions of food and everything like that, but how this organism does against the other organisms that happen to be there. So different runs may lead to different organisms becoming better because there's a different population that they face. Okay, so that would be the code for the world. And then you'd need code that would be, keeping track of the different lineages, which lineages were still surviving, counting the number of lineages that go extinct, tracking at any one time the stability of the distribution of species. So if the same species of organisms are there for a long time, you want to note how long that has been stable. And if there's some sudden change, some organism comes in that destabilizes the current ecology, you want to be able to you want to be able to observe and track in a file, the changing concentrations of different species over time. And then you'll need tools that will analyze that and say, well, be able to look at the data and say, we've had, we had this many ecosystems that lasted this long. And so you want to be able to do some analysis of the data and ask for the distributions of different stability times and things like that. What sort of statistics can you get out of it? You need to be able to, as in any experimental laboratory, you need to run experiments over and over and over and over again and collect statistics on them, because each experiment will come out a little differently. And one experiment may lead to one very, very, very stable, long ecology. Another experiment may lead to lots of little short ones, but overall you will gain some statistical confidence that there is a distribution that's sort of emerging when you run thousands and thousands of these. So it's like doing any other kind of science. What you need is the proper tools to do proper experiments. Now, these happen to be software tools as opposed to hardware tools, but you need to sort of recreate the equivalent of a scientist's laboratory workbench. You need the Petri dish, the microscope, the stuff that's recording the data, and the stuff that's doing analysis. So it's you set up virtual laboratories in the computer to do proper science and try to do it in such a way that other people can repeat your work.
From 1987, the year of the first conference, you were in Los Alamos Laboratory, until now, info technology and computers evolved dramatically, and this technological evolution has radically modified real life and the real world, mm-hmm. not only the science of complexity, but what about the changes in AL in terms of technology, methodology, and experimental results from the beginning
right.
until now?
Okay, so one of the main things that's happened is that many more people have their own computers. Okay, so the democratization of somebody once made a comparison to the 60s with when electric guitars, musical instruments, yeah. became cheap enough for high school kids to buy them, and all of a sudden everybody started bands, and you could do your own music. You didn't have to be in a studio, and you didn't have to be. So the same thing happened with computers. Once the personal computer came out, so my own story is fairly typical of this transition, was that I had a hard time doing this work in the late 70s, because I had to convince people to give me time on the mainframe computers to run these. And when I'd say what I wanted to do, they'd say, "What? Why would you want to do that?" So it was very difficult for me to get computer time. And it wasn't, see, these programs don't require big computers, but they need to run for a while. So the programs are actually fairly simple. It's not like a huge, massive physics calculation that needs a supercomputer. The code is very simple, but it needs to run for a long time. So you need long evolutionary time scales to see interesting things happen. But its time on a computer is very expensive, or it was at that time. So when the Apple computer first came out, I bought one of the first Apples to come out, and then I could spend whatever time I wanted on my own computer. So that democratization that happened when people got to decide whatever they wanted to do on a computer was a very critical thing. And an Apple computer was fine for doing a lot of things. Matter of fact, you know, most AI, artificial life work still gets done just on PCs or very simple computers. It doesn't need you can get such interesting phenomenology out of simple programs that you don't really need supercomputers. Now, for some of the programs, like some of the stuff that's going on with Tierra or Avida, it's now progressed to the stage where it would be very useful to use massive supercomputers so you can run very big populations and you can repeat experiments over and over again. So a lot of computational resources are required. But you know, the impact of the increase in speed of computers and everything like that hasn't yet had that much of an impact on the field because there's so much that you can still do with very simple computers. And in fact, there's so much that people could have been doing with the IBM 360s a long time ago. It was just that people weren't aware that anything interesting would come out of this. It took people just trying it and then seeing that interesting stuff did happen, and that validated the idea, and then people went out and they did it. So it isn't that you need supercomputers. However, you know, it's clear that supercomputers and faster computers are going to have a big impact on the field, because especially for evolution, one of the reasons we've got so much biological diversity and everything like that is the enormous number of things that get tested in each other's presence. I mean, the huge numbers of actual organisms that have lived and died, and the huge number of species that have gone extinct. There was a very interesting piece of work by Carl Sims, who was at Thinking Machines. I don't know if you've seen this. You should definitely see this work. Carl Sims. K-A-R-L. S-I-M-S. And I'll find for you. You can pull down an MPEG file that shows these digital creatures and the results of evolution. Well, he was at Thinking Machines, which was this company in Boston that made these massively parallel computers. And he was sort of the resident artist. And he used evolution to evolve sort of organisms that had interesting sort of kinetic capabilities. His goal was to have interesting animations. He achieved some tremendously interesting adaptations on the part of these creatures. They developed some very interesting structures, especially when they were in competition with each other. And it was a very elegant illustration of the power of Darwinian evolution. But he was able to do this because he was running on a supercomputer in which he could look at 300 variants of each organism at any one time step. And so he was at any one evolutionary time step, it's extremely important to have breadth, to be looking at lots and lots and lots of different variants. And then you pick the ones that do the best, and then you go to the next generation. Had he been constrained to only look at, say, 10 variants at each generation, and pick the best one and then go on to the next, he never would have gotten the interesting stuff that he did. So particularly for evolutionary algorithms, large population sizes are the larger population sizes you can get with respect to, you know, the number of variants you can be looking at with the, you know, when compared with the number of possible variants is a ratio that is an interesting one to know about. I mean, if that ratio is too small, then there won't be enough structure for evolution to exploit. It can be very small and yet still be big enough for evolution to be able to discover interesting structure. But that breadth is every bit as important as temporal depth. So supercomputer technology and more powerful computers are going to have an impact as we get to the point where it's critical that we are able to look at lots of variants at any one time step.
So if I sum up, contrary to the, please have your cigarette, I don't want to, contrary to the real world, technology has a bigger impact in the last 10 years, but in the future, the parameter of powerful computer will have a bigger impact on AI.
I think so, yeah. I mean, once again, it's, you know, it will have a bigger impact, but I think that there's still plenty of work that could easily be done with just, you know, an Apple II. You know, it's just for people to go out and try things.
In artificial life, there is we tend to accord more importance to the process of life or than to the physical supports of life. There is more.
So to the function rather than its implementation.
So, yes, you consider yourself as a functionalist. What this conception of life means precisely?
It's a very simple thing. It's just the acknowledgement that the same logic can be implemented physically in many different ways. So you have the same functional building blocks. So, for instance, you could build a computer that would run Windows out of Tinker Toys, but you'd have to build the logical functions by Tinker Toy and an OR gates that would knock against each other. You can build a computer out of optics. You can build a computer out of water tubes with water flowing through it. You can build a computer out of electronics. You can build a computer in many, many different ways that will implement AND and OR gates. The critical functionalities are AND and OR gates, effectively, for a computer. And there are many physical ways to implement those. And once you have these logical primitives AND and OR gates, you can build up arbitrary logics out of those. So now sometimes people interpret my stance as saying you don't need hardware, that somehow life is strictly information. But that's not what I'm saying at all. Of course, something has to implement the logic, but there's no requirement to be this material versus that material. And therefore, the material is in many ways immaterial to the functions that we're really at, or that are the critical functions for biology. And we assume that, you know, it is possible that we'll go to other star systems eventually, and we'll discover life built with not on carbon chain chemistry, but maybe on a chemistry of silicon. In different temperature and pressure regimes, silicon has as interesting chemical structures as carbon does. I mean, it's possible that the same kinds of behavioral primitives could have been implemented in silicon, or that there are other behavioral primitives that are more natural to silicon. It's not so much important the material as the functional aspect. So, for instance, for Darwinian evolution, it's those two functions of there have to be variants of the genomes produced, and there has to be some filter on it. And you can implement those genomes you could do it with Tinker Toys, you could do it with lots of things. So the specific material is nowhere near as important as the functions, although different materials will naturally give rise to different functions that could have been exploited by evolution. So the material is important, but it's not critical. It's not essential.
So we can say that the process of life is more important to your views than the...
Right. For theoretical biology, in order to be able to understand life wherever we find it in the universe, is going to have to be at a level of abstraction above carbon chain chemistry. I mean, it's important to understand carbon chain chemistry because we need to understand the way life really does work and how the hardware works, but that's not the only thing we need to understand about it. We need to understand what the functions are that this hardware implements and the implications of the logic that those functions implement.
I think you coined the term of artificial life, but the term also was one of your colleagues, I think, the term of age of chaos. Is that right?
Because the what? The, yeah.
You're the concept of...
several people came up with this concept sort of independently. Okay. All of us were studying either dynamical systems or cellular automata. So either continuous or discrete dynamical systems. So the edge of chaos was my computation at the edge of chaos was my PhD thesis. And the hypothesis there was that, so you want me to explain something?
Yes, because for me, if I understand, is it the same synonym of phase transition or not?
Yeah, this has to do with phase transition. Yeah.
Okay.
So let me back up a little bit and say...
In a few words, what's the relevance of this notion, the relevance to localize the age of chaos in a system?
Yeah, okay. So, let me just think of where to start. For dynamical systems and chaos theory, it was observed that there are sort of three universality classes that of behavior that are exhibited by dynamical systems. If you give a function like the logistic equation, you start it off at an initial point, and then you run the function, you get a new point, and then you run the function on it again, and you get a new point. And so in the space in which these points are, over time you get a trajectory of points. Okay, so it's x1, x2, x3, x4. Each one running another step of the equation on that variable. So there are three sort of three universal classes of what can happen to those trajectories over time. One is that trajectory reaches a point and then it stays there. So the function might go to zero from some arbitrary point, and then it'll end up. And an example would be a pendulum. Okay, so you swing a pendulum, no matter where you start it, eventually it's going to go, and it'll stay there for the rest of time. So if you plot the angular velocity against the angular displacement for a pendulum, you'll see it spiral in to the center point and stop. No matter where you start it, it will end up at that point. If you had a frictionless pendulum, you would see that wherever you started it, it would just go in a circle. Okay, you start at any point on a circle, and it will just come back to that point eventually. So it might go to a point and stay there. It might go into a cycle and stay there, or it might never close on itself, the trajectory. So it might wander around and never hit the same point again. And those are really the only three possibilities. It reaches a point and stays there. It reaches a set of points and stays there. Or it never hits the same point twice. And so the first one is called fixed point dynamics. The second one is called periodic dynamics. And the third one is effectively chaotic dynamics. Now, there are various different ways in which it might not ever close on itself. If you can put a finite bound, so if it reaches an area for a continuous variable space, so real valued variable space, you can put a bound around it that it will never escape from once it's got inside, then it's reached an attractor, effectively. You can say that it's reached an attractor, and it will not hit every point, and it will not come close, it'll come a lot closer to some of those points than to others, and it will come very close to some points forever, and it will stay very far away from other points forever. So you can say something about the structure, the topological structure of where in that space it orbits. So you've seen these pictures of attractors,
yeah, absolutely,
like the Lorentz attractor, which looks like a butterfly. So you can characterize the topological structure that the orbit, this is called, is restricted to. If the system is just random, so you can have very ordered chaotic behavior so that you can say a lot about what the trajectory is going to do, although you can't say exactly where it's going to be. But you can also have very, very random looking chaos where it just seems to bounce around all over the place and there's no topological structure you can characterize. It just kind of eventually will sort of fill the space arbitrarily, but it will never hit the same point twice. So then you have high degree of randomness, very little you can say structurally, or very little structure that there is to characterize mathematically. But there are those three classes. Now, for things like cellular automata, Stephen Wolfram, when he started studying cellular automata, he noted that there seemed to be four classes of behavior. The same three. Seemed to be fixed point, where the cellular automaton would reach a state and then stop. There were CA that would settle down to periodic behavior, like so that you would have things that would, in a two-dimensional lattice, that would flip back and forth every two time steps. The periods might be very long; they might be 100 time steps before they would repeat. And then there were the ones which just seemed to look very random. So he said that they were the equivalent of chaotic dynamical systems, except these are not real valued; they're discrete valued systems. So, in other words, that the trajectories would go on effectively forever before they reached the same state of the lattice. But then there seemed to be this fourth class that were things like the game of life. I don't know if you've ever seen Conway's Game of Life, where it might go on for an arbitrary period of time and then all of a sudden become a fixed point or become periodic, or it might not settle down, or it might, over its span of time, look like it was about to become periodic but then not become periodic and get very complex again. So there seemed to be a class of cellular automata that didn't have an analog in dynamical systems theory. So he introduced what he called this fourth class four, which he used as an example of class four, the game of life. And since it had been proven for the game of life, the game of life was capable of supporting a computer. In other words, you can take gliders and blinkers and things like that, and you can build the equivalent of a stored program computer in it. That meant that the ultimate dynamics for that system were undecidable. You could not say for a particular run whether it would go to a fixed point, whether it would be very chaotic forever. So there was an intrinsic inability to classify this class as being one of the other three. So there seemed to be another class. And he said it's not clear that there is an analog for these systems in continuous dynamical systems. So he asked the question, what is there about this class that, or can we locate such a class in continuous dynamical systems? So when I started working with cellular automata, for continuous dynamical systems, you can often define a parameter, the nonlinearity parameter, which if you set it very low, the same equation will generate fixed point behavior. You know, so no matter what initial condition you are, if you turn that parameter up a little bit, you'll get periodic behavior. And if you turn it up even higher, eventually you'll go through a transition from periodic behavior to chaotic behavior. So the same equation, okay, so it's not a different equation, it's just you've raised the parameter of the system, and that's typically called the nonlinearity parameter. So you've maybe seen these charts of the logistic equation that show the bifurcation diagram of the dynamics as you turn this nonlinearity parameter. You go from fixed point to period 2, period 4, period 8, period 16, and eventually you come to a point at which you go the transition to chaos, so the onset of chaos, and then beyond that, the system behaves very chaotically if you have the parameter tuned higher. So I defined the equivalent of a nonlinearity parameter for cellular automata, something that when I had it set to very low values, I got very fixed point behavior of cellular automata, and when I set it very high, it just looked random, and it would never repeat itself. If you'd been able to run an infinite lattice, it never would have repeated itself. So I could tune that knob up and down, and I could go from fixed point to periodic to chaotic dynamics. But I noticed that right around the transition from periodic behavior to chaotic behavior, you saw the kinds of dynamics that you see in the game of life. You saw the propagating structures like gliders. So you saw a mix of sort of chaotic behavior and very periodic behavior. So most of the dynamics in things like the games of life, most of the areas settle down to very periodic behavior, very stable behavior, but some areas are still continuing to be not settling down. So in those systems, there seem to be a mix between the periodic behaviors and the chaotic behaviors. And you know, for many of those, I was able to build things like AND and OR gates. So there seemed to be something about the cellular automata that I could find by tuning this parameter. When I had that parameter set right to the point where just if I'd raised it a little more, it would have been just chaotic behavior that gave rise in the dynamics of these CAs to the building blocks for computation. So my thesis basically was that at this transition to chaos, the systems that are at that transition regime, you know, right very close to that regime, have intrinsically in their dynamics the possibility to implement arbitrary computations. And therefore, it was that computational potential for computational capability that gave rise to this undecidability. And so therefore, I was able to answer the question, what's the relationship between this fourth class and the other three classes of dynamical systems by saying, this fourth class you find at the transition to chaos. So that should be true for continuous dynamical systems as well. And in fact, it turned out that when people set the nonlinearity parameter for continuous dynamical systems right to the transition point, they got similar fluctuations and similar the systems wouldn't settle down. They might seem to be periodic for a very long period of time, but then they'd burst out into chaotic behavior again. I think my thesis was the first one to suggest that to locate that fourth class and say, yeah, this does fall within the scope of continuous dynamical systems. So that's the relationship to phase transitions. And in particular, I propose that the interesting cellular automata or the interesting dynamical systems would be the ones that exhibit what's called a second order phase transition, which has sort of different dynamical characteristics than first order phase transition.
In which year did you finish the thesis?
Well, it took me. I initially published some of the results from my thesis work in 1985, I think. But I got all caught up in the artificial life workshops and things like that, and so I ran two of those before I finished my thesis, before I published it. And during that time, I spent at both Los Alamos and the Santa Fe Institute, and so I talked about it a lot, and I wrote a number of papers about it before I actually finished the thesis. So the thesis, I think, was 91 when I finally published my thesis. I got in a lot of trouble because I'd taken a postdoctoral position at Los Alamos, and then I hadn't finished I hadn't actually published my thesis yet. But it was worth it because I think it was a good thing to do to start those artificial life conferences. So my thesis was actually that at that time was that since life is very dependent on information processing, my thesis was that life may have originated in the physical world when some piece of the physical world was in the vicinity of one of these transitions, and so the information processing capability emerged at that point and was able to dominate just strictly energy dynamics. That information processing began to play a role and was selected for, and that it ran off after that. Yeah. But a lot of that was just mostly my speculations.
Yeah. In running the universe in computer simulation, in helping artificial life, in helping to unveil the properties of being alive, also is there some ontological ethics? Is there any particular metaphysics adjacent to life in your simulation? Do you have something like spirituality?
No, I
does notion like spirituality makes sense in an artificial universe? Is that particular?
Well, the, I wouldn't put it in those terms, but I think that the important thing that has come out of complexity theory is the understanding of this notion of emergence. Okay. So when you have, so the best place to let me just illustrate it with an example. For an insect colony, each individual ant is at any one instant is surrounded by the state, the structure, and the distribution of the other ants, and the structure of the colony in which they live, the nest in which they live, and the state of the chemicals that they're releasing, the signaling chemicals, the pheromones, and things like that. And so its behavior is determined by its immediate environment, the signals that it's getting immediately, and a little bit of memory, and then it does something as a result of responding to these local structure. Now, when they all do this, they all then modify the structure, and there's a global pattern that emerges, and the dynamics of the whole colony have the whole colony has capabilities as a result of all of these interactions that are beyond the capability of the simple sum. In other words, you don't just have n times an ant. Hmm. You don't have if you've got 1,000 ants, it's not, the colony isn't just like a 1,000 ant.
You have more.
So it's nonlinear. The behavior of the whole is more than just the sum of the parts. And the way this comes about is that, there are processes happen at the level of the whole colony. There's structure to the global dynamics, which in turn it's the local ramifications of that global emergent structure that determine the boundary conditions within which each individual that it sees and that it reacts to. So you have the insects responding to their local conditions, which aggregated together the global dynamics produces new local conditions, which then the ants respond to. So there's this feedback loop between what the individuals see locally, what they do as a response to that in affecting local structure. So it's how individual behaviors affect global structure, and then in turn how global structure affects individual behaviors. So the closest I could come to something like spirit would be the processes that are going on way above the heads, if you will, of the individual ants, these emergent flows, dynamical flows of information throughout the system, are almost like the kinds of things that the vitalist wanted, the sort of these higher level principles that were organizing the behavior of matter, but they don't exist independent of the insect. So it's this feedback loop between the individual organisms and the global dynamics, and how individual organisms structure the global dynamics, and how the global dynamics structures the context within which the individual organisms then act. If this is what you'd want to call spirit, I would call these higher order emergent things that somehow get in the individual insects in their grip. So an example of that is a pheromone-mediated food trail. So if an ant wanders out of the nest and finds a bit of food, he takes some of the food and he heads back toward the nest and deposits this chemical which diffuses. So you've seen this. Okay. Now that attracts other insects which find the food and deposit the chemical, and which attracts more, and then so pretty soon you have this structure of this pheromone which is constantly both evaporating but being replenished constantly by the insects. So that's a structure at the level of the global dynamics, is that long trail of pheromones. Now, so the insects are when they decide what to do, they follow that trail. And when they follow that trail, they're led to the food. And once they get the food, they deposit the chemical, which maintains that structure. So in some sense, you could say that structure kind of has the insects in its grip. I mean, they are being guided by that structure. But at the same time, the insects produce that structure. So there's a feedback loop between what the local individuals do. They follow the trail. And what the trail does, it guides the insects. And the insects maintain the trail. As soon as the food is gone, they don't deposit the chemical, and that structure evaporates, and then that structure doesn't really have a grip on, such a tight grip on the ants, and they sort of get released to get caught up in other such emergent structures. And so it's the constant, you know, formation, maintenance, and then evaporation of these higher order patterns that determine the structure of the individuals, but in turn are determined by them, that I think is a critical thing to understand out of complex systems is you know, the multiple levels at which those kinds of things can arise and the multiple ways in which evolution has discovered these emergent structures and been able to exploit them.
In the light of artificial life, could we also learn something radically new concerning the finality of life? We are just always studying the origin of life, and that death is part of life, and it's a radical phase transition, but could we learn something about this notion of death?
I think so. I think there have been some studies that have actually showed that death can be selected for in a population of organisms because death allows. If organisms aren't dying, then you're not. Eventually the organisms that exist are don't allow for the introduction of new variants. I mean, for evolution to work, you have to be introducing new variants all the time. But if the ecosystem is full up of things which live forever, then you're not introducing new variants. Now, I don't think we're learning anything new about this because this was Malthus's point about the exponential increase, the tendency toward exponential increase of organisms versus the geometrical increase of food resources. So that there had to be death. not everything could live. So if evolution is going to have the opportunity to have new variants introduced in the population, old ones have to go away. They have to drop out as competitors for the resources. Otherwise, you're not introducing new variations. So populations of immortals tend not to evolve because the function of producing new variants is not strong enough. They will be outcompeted by systems which are more able to introduce new variants, which can learn to take advantage, come up with a new skill which will outcompete the immortals. So if this new population allows the introduction of these new variants by having older organisms die off, then you could say that death would get selected for because that population is more evolvable, it's more adaptive, it can do end runs around the other population. So I think that there are some studies that indicate that death is an essential part of life. Given that, for life to evolve, to develop more complexity, become more sophisticated, so that now, whether that means that death is essential, and whether we will—I mean, I think it's possible—we'll discover how to make human beings immortal at some point. The question is, do we stop evolution when that happens? I think not, because for humans. For humans, a very interesting thing has happened, okay, which is that with the introduction of language and culture, our behavior, what we do, our capabilities, our adaptiveness is now much more a function of things that we inherit culturally than things that we inherit biologically. And So you can have the death of an idea without having the death of the organism that does that. So if you were behaving according to a certain idea and that turned out not to be very adaptive, you could just adopt a different idea and start behaving that way, and the organism wouldn't have to die, but something had to die, right? The information had to die. Mm-hmm. Previously, with biology, if the information died, the organism died. I mean, it was so tightly connected with the life of the organism. But with culture, the information can die without the organism dying, and I think that's one of the reasons that culture has taken over so much, is that you can explore the space of variants of information that encodes behavior. You can evolve rules for behavior without having to kill off the organisms that are the carriers of them. So it's a much more efficient way to explore the space of behavior determination. In other words, the sort of the genetics, but genetics at the level of culture. Either one, the important thing is what organisms do. So if they can change what they do by just adopting a different idea, then that lineage of ideas may eventually die out, but the organisms that carried them don't have to. So during the Crusades, you know, if you would not convert to Christianity, they killed you. But you had the option of converting to Christianity, so you adopted a different belief, and then you continued to live and have offspring. Okay, so the evolution discovered a very interesting thing, which is a reprogrammable set of behaviors and a more efficient way to explore the possible behaviors.
You said once that AL simulation forced you to look over your shoulders about the assumptions you make about the real world. What do you mean by this?
Well, that a lot of different things. One is just the way in which, you know, this notion of the feedback loop between the global dynamics and the individual. We think that we're very free will, and we determine much of what we do, but we are very dependent on these emergent structures, the sociocultural institutions, and we're very constrained by them. In many ways, we are in the grip of the sociocultural function structures, just the way the ants are in the grip of that pheromone-mediated trail. I mean, I'm not so much a sociobiologist. I mean, this could be, sociobiology was very much saying it was the genes that force us to be like insects. But I think even culture and language and belief structures, you know, I mean, this is good because we benefit as individuals by subsuming ourselves a little bit to societal dynamics. We all come out better if we give up a little of our pure free will. I mean, we're not free to do. We are free to do anything we want to do, but we do better, we're more fit as individuals if we allow ourselves to be driven around a little bit by a society, because a society has capabilities at the level of the whole society that none of us have individually, so we can be better fed, better clothed, our offspring can survive better if we participate in civilization. Watching the way in which, you know, it's a tremendous role that these emergent structures play, these higher order dynamics that then sort of enslave, not in a bad sense, but that sort of constrain our behavior and the choices we have. I became much more aware of that in my daily life. But I also, you know, here I created a cellular automaton, and I created the physics, and I created everything like that, and then I sit back and I watch it, and I believe that in some of these cellular automata, you could have the development of life, and eventually these creatures could develop something like intelligence, and they would ask theological questions about their origin. So in some ways, this has opened up for me in a different way. I was in a creator-creation relationship between myself. I created the physics, but I'm not omnipotent, I'm not omniscient with respect to that physics. I don't know what's going to happen in it. I mean, I don't control it. You know, I'm not doing it. Once I start it, it's running according to physics, but just because I created the rules doesn't mean that I know what kinds of dynamics those rules are going to give rise to. So it changed for me my understanding about what religion could be about and what a god could be. I mean, I was pretty much an atheist, and now I'm back to being an agnostic, I guess, is saying I know less. I didn't believe in the Christian idea of the God who creates everything and supports every sparrow and has a plan and everything's happening according to a plan. I don't necessarily believe that there was some conscious entity that created the universe, but the understanding of what a creator could know about its creation and what could come about and was changed significantly by my experience with these systems. And also just the whole notion that the more we get involved with the determination of biology, you know, people constantly say that somebody gets this disease or has this genetic flaw, it's an act of God, you know. Mm-hmm. But the more we can go in and manipulate that, you know, give a gene therapy or change this, then we are becoming much more involved in the manipulation of the low-level generators of biological behavior. And so we're coming more into a creator-creation relationship. And this lack of omniscience becomes much more critical because we can't know the evolutionary consequences of the sorts of manipulations we're doing now. We're mucking around with the rules that our own universe is obeying.
So and your field of research, there's danger also.
But we're also, I think, pointing out the fact that stuff that we're doing already, you know, introducing genetically modified organisms in the environment and things like that, the scientists say, well, it's perfectly safe, but we know that you can't know that. You can't know what many of the downstream consequences are going to be. You're going to affect the further development of this pest, which may be the feed for this. I mean, we know that when you go in and start messing around with these very complex systems that have a lot of emergence in them, a lot of nonlinear interactions, that often what looks like a really good idea has very terrible consequences downstream because they could not be predicted. And it's good to know that there's danger here, and it's good to know why there's danger, and it's good to study in computers before you do it in the real world. It's good to The only way you can know, in many ways, the reason we do a lot of these simulations, the only way you can know is to do lots of runs and see what are the possible consequences of making this change in the system. I mean, that's, I think, the reason that evolution is there, is it's the only way that you can discover what's good and what's bad is by running it. And if we have the opportunity to run it in computers first and see some of the emerging consequences, we'll do things more carefully in the real world, although we'll never be able to do it perfectly because we'll never be able to simulate the real world perfectly. But we can get a much better awareness of some possible, you know, we can avoid some major catastrophes that, you know, once we run the computer simulation, we say, oh, geez, of course, no, God, we shouldn't do that. Good thing we saw it here first.
Sorry for interrupting you, but is Denmark any danger in doing the computer simulation? The danger is not inside the...
Well, for a number of reasons, yes. Originally, people thought, well, you're just doing a computer, there's no danger there. But, you know, the computer is now part of reality. For with the net and the web, you know, this is now part of our physical reality. It's no longer just something a bunch of geeks do out there. You know, commerce, finance, everything's happening on the net. And so yeah, the fact that we're doing these things in computers is there's the potential for danger there. If you introduce evolving agents who are buying and selling stocks, then you're going to have this kind of emergence, and you're going to have the possibility of these spontaneous ecological collapses, and we are all going to be very impacted by that. But it's not so And then, of course, there's all the stuff about viruses and information warfare and things like that. But I think, you know, in general, just biological life and information technology are just becoming more and more integrated. We are completely dependent on information technology right now, and so therefore we're physically very dependent on that information technology working. But I think that it's not just that we're doing things which are potentially dangerous, that artificial life is doing things which are potentially dangerous in that world. People are implementing logics which are going to give rise to this kind of emergent behavior and emergent dynamics who don't consider themselves evolutionary, you know, are a life people. I mean, information technologists are setting the stage for the information network to begin to exhibit these emergent behaviors. So it's very important that we understand what this class of dynamical system can do and what ways it can go bad and what ways in which it could go good. I mean, any knowledge like this, like the knowledge of atomic fission or fusion, could be used for both good purposes and bad purposes. And so we need to treat it with the kind of respect that we have for any new invention in technology, that it can be used, it can have many different implications, but we it doesn't mean we shouldn't study it. I mean, because we, by studying it, we can avoid some major catastrophes, I think, even though we're providing people with the tools to produce major catastrophes. It's, in my opinion, it's better to know.
My last question is about, you said to John Holden, I think, that you have the feeling that culturally there's going to be more of something like poetry in the future of science. I like this notion that it's...
Boy, did I...
misinterpreted.
It's been... he purposely...
Yeah, I know.
Horgan purposely took quotes out of context. The whole statement was... Okay, so he left out the critical... next line, which is that, but of course we have to be true to our charter to make verifiable statements of the world. It's just that poets can use language in a way which I can give you actually my little essay on it, which I gave to Horgan.
Yeah, I would like to.
I'd give it to you now, but my computer's dead, so.
If you have it,
but I can send it. I can send it by email. But my point was that as scientists, we have to use language in a very linear way. So we are very careful that we have terms which are defined sort of context-free, so that this term means this in any context in which it's used. Okay, and therefore, a scientific paper is restricted to being the linear sum of the definitions. It can't be anything more than that. The paper can't change the definition of a term somehow, because of the context, whereas a poet uses language in a very nonlinear way, so that the emergent meaning of the poem somehow comes back for you and redefines many of the terms in ways that you never would have thought them to be used. So Robert Frost can say, you know, two paths diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by. Well, path. He means something else by it, and there's a tremendous amount of, I'm not a poet, and so I don't know how to describe this very well, but I know that poets can make statements about the emergent aspects of life, which we all know to be true, we all deal with every day, but which we're never going to be able to get at if we restrict ourselves to linear scientific language. Now, we are perfectly happy to allow ourselves nonlinear mathematics, and I think we're going to have to, as scientists, allow the nonlinear use of language in our scientific papers. But, I said, so therefore scientific language is going to have to be more like poetry, because poets can say more than scientists can. They can talk about phenomena that we can't talk about yet. Or when we do, we're called flaky. Because people can turn around and say, yeah, but that's not what that term means. You know, you've changed the meaning of that term. And verifiability for science depends on not redefining the terms. So we sort of break, we say something, because, so we put together some combination of terms to describe something new, And it's the fact that we understand each of those terms and exactly what the sum of those terms means that means that we've said something verifiable, because we can understand the pieces out of which it's built. If somehow that statement changes the meaning of those terms, then we don't understand what those terms mean anymore, and we get into this sort of feedback loop where the thing drifts away from anything that we, quote, know. But the final statement I said in there was, but at the same time, we have to be true to our charter to make verifiable statements of the world, so we need to understand how to use language in a nonlinear way, more like the poets, but to maintain the verifiability. And so that's something I think science is going to have to discover, is how we can we also can make use and talk about these very nonlinear kinds of phenomena without losing this notion of verifiability and repeatability. So the title of this essay was sort of the scientist's dilemma. There's a dilemma here. I wasn't just saying, yeah. You know, we need more poet scientists, so I think that would help. Okay. And I closed with, I modified one of Robert Frost's poems. I said, the words are lovely, dark, and deep, but we have promises to keep and miles to go before we sleep. And, you know, we're all tempted by poetry, and we all, as scientists in our head, we do a lot of that in our head, but we never publish that in our papers. We wait. We don't say any of that. We wait until we've got it all nailed down, and we just take one piece of it, which we can nail down in a very linear way, and then we say that. That's what we publish. But what motivates us to science, where we get our insights, what we're really drawn to is this whole poetical side of things. The things that we understand as human beings and natural language users, and it's an important part of science, and it was part of what the Santa Fe Institute was about, was recognizing the importance that what we see, you know, and what we intuit comes out of that kind of an understanding of the world. And there can be, you know, very elegant, very good scientists have often, you know, gotten their insights out of some sort of a very non-scientific process, but then they get very scientific about it. And just my whole statement was, it's got to be more okay. It's got to be accepted that we're able to talk about that side of the scientific process, because probably every bit as important, if not more so, as the part where, well, once you have the insight, then you nail it down.